For a lot of us, these past 18 months have meant spending much more time in the places where we live. Maybe you found refuge in neighborhood walks or the woods by your home. Maybe it's long scenic drives that are doing it for you. For author Jerry Dennis, who lives in Traverse City, his refuge is just outside his front door.
I can walk out my door and cross the field into woods or drive a few miles to public trails and a public park. So those places have became very important in the pandemic because they were so easy to get to, and I could do that every day.
Dennis has actually written a new book about these spaces. It's a love letter of sorts called Up North in Michigan, A Portrait of Place Across Four Seasons. Today we're talking to Jerry Dennis about his love of the landscape and what it means when the place you've known for a lifetime transforms because of climate change. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. In the introduction to his new book, Jerry Dennis mentions that he asked some friends to describe what up north means to them. Here's what they had to say.
One said that it was the moment when they passed into the hilly country north of Clare and around West Branch and on the west side of the state north of Muskegon, hilly and wooded. And another said that it was the aromas of woods and of the Great Lakes. There was just something about that that wasn't found anywhere else in the country. One even said that he's convinced that the quality of the light is different, that it filters off the Great Lakes through the pine trees and gives it a peculiar and very particular bluish green tint.
I think it's absolutely true. I mean, maybe also in part to do with where the UP and the northern part of the Mitten lie in terms of latitude, that there is something about the light for sure. What does being up north mean to you?
Well, it's home for me. You know, it's where I grew up. I was born in Flint, but my mother's family goes back five or six generations in Leelanau County. So we came up north, you know, as often as we could. And it was my father's dream to live up here. He grew up in Bay City. So those first 5 years in Flint, he was a police officer, and his main dream was to get a place on the water in northern Michigan. So I think it was the day I finished kindergarten, we packed the car and headed up north to near Traverse City, and that's where I grew up. So for me, it's home. Many of the qualities that my friends talked about, the hilly country, the wooded country, the glacial remnants, you know, the land that was shaped by the glaciers, and for me, particularly the water, the Great Lakes, of course, and the inland lakes where I grew up on Long Lake in Grand Traverse County, for a while also on Silver Lake, and the rivers. There's that very specific northern Michigan feel to our rivers, especially the Trout Rivers. They're pool and riffle streams with leaning cedars. And there's a real feel and aroma to those rivers that isn't found anywhere else that I've seen in the world. And I've traveled a lot of the world just to look at rivers and spend time on them.
Yeah. You spend a lot of time talking in the book about taking advantage of each of the seasons. And since we're here in fall now, I was wondering if we could ask you to read an excerpt about autumn from the book.
Oh, I'd be happy to. When I was a kid, I liked fall best, October especially, month of my birth, of crisp nights and colored leaves, of Halloween and apple cider and firewood that had to be split and stacked before winter. Summer was trivial, made for children and tourists, but autumn was somber, solemn, mature. It made me impatient to grow up. On windy October days when I was 12, I would stand on the shore of Long Lake and watch the year get swept away and be overwhelmed with a delicious sorrow. The season clarified me. It was sepulchral. It was elegiac. I savored its bittersweet tang. The poet Donald Hall once wrote that Michigan's fall is like Europe's, burnished old gold, yellow harvest mellow with violins, autumn of the falling fruit and the long journey toward oblivion, muted and melancholy. Though surely he was thinking of Ann Arbor, where he once lived and taught, and not the wooded and hilly rural north where autumn's colors bloom in operatic excess. Up here is as different from Ann Arbor as Eagle Pond is from Harvard Square. But Hall was right about the melancholy, the falling fruit and the journey toward oblivion. We have all three in abundance. Every dropped leaf, every skidding rain, every flock of geese passing overhead reminds us of winter's approach. Were the day as a movie, the soundtrack would be mostly cellos. We become suddenly industrious and hurry outside to gather all the music and fragrance we can hold, stocking up on sensations for the sterile months ahead. If we must stay indoors, we settle into a chair beside the fireplace and open the first of the season's thick novels. Either way, we're digging in against oblivion.
Mm. That passage includes one of my favorite phrases in the book, the fact that fall made you impatient to grow up. I really like the way that so much of how you think about the land is sort of in relationship to time and how it forms and shapes our relationship to time. Why is it that you wanted to structure the book this way?
Well, it felt natural, of course. I've always been fascinated with the changes that the seasons bring, the fact that every season, in one sense, is the same. Every time it comes around, every time fall comes around, it's the same fall we've had forever. And yet, of course, everyone is unique, and every day is a surprise. And I've always just been so interested in that that I've made a point of paying as close attention as I can. So it was a very natural way to break up the book. And also, it was one I'd used before in a book that was published in 1992, way back then. It's Raining Frogs and Fishes, about wonders of the sky. Artist Glenn Wolfe and I broke that book up also into four seasons, and it worked so well and it was so fun that I'd always wanted to do it again.
Yeah. Summer, in theory, is the season in which I think most people connect with the land in Michigan. And I guess that's especially true up north, since so many people choose to visit at that time. But at the same time, I feel like, and the book maybe provides us some examples of this, it may also be the time in which the changes in land have been most obvious. I wonder, could you share what you've observed about climate change up north during the summer months?
Well, yeah, it's becoming more and more obvious, of course. You know, the storms, the rain events, the heat. Although, you know, heat isn't always an indicator, because we are cooled off by the winds off the Great Lakes. But we're seeing it, definitely. There's a real change going on. Part of it is, of course, that there are more people than ever, and sometimes we're a little shocked. I live in Traverse City, and it's a little shocking to see the traffic traffic in Traverse City in the summer. It's not what I grew up with at all. I sure don't blame anyone, but the climate is affecting life here, both in the natural world and in our own lives, is becoming really obvious. We're seeing some changes in wildlife behavior and patterns, migration patterns. We're seeing birds up here regularly now that were quite rare 20 years ago. There's a lot of examples. There's the white-footed mouse, which has migrated northward and has now pretty much pushed out all the other mouse species. Lake Superior is warming faster than almost any large lake in the world. Some statistics say it is faster than any other lake. And the changes there are starting to become very dramatic, and you're seeing that in the summer. Algae blooms is the most obvious one. Mm-hmm. Lake Superior never had algae blooms. The water was too cold for algae. Now,
right. The
bays, places like Thunder Bay, Ontario, in the eastern end around Duluth and Shequamagon Bay in Wisconsin, are seeing some major blue-green algae explosions that potentially are toxic. Once they start noticing this, then, of course, everyone also becomes aware that other invasive species like zebra and quagga mussels are going to start invading Lake Superior. They've been kept at bay by the cold water, but that's not going to last much longer. Forests are changing around the shores of Lake Superior. That spruce moose biome, as biologists and botanists call it, on the North Shore in Ontario, is starting to be infiltrated by hardwoods, which is quite new and part of natural forest succession, but it's being driven unnaturally by rising temperatures.
Just one more thing about, you know, the changes that you've observed. There were a couple of passages in the book where you talk about how even the dynamics of the water can seem a little bit different with the ferocity of the storms and weather patterns that we get these days. Can you say a little bit about what it's like being out on the lake at a stormy time?
Well, yes, I have had that experience. And obviously, the Great Lakes have always been stormy, and they're famous for it, especially in the fall. November storms are legendary. And what we're seeing, of course, are greater ferocity in wind storms year-round now. And high water, that's an interesting phenomenon. It's always happened. There's always been this roughly 10-year cycle of high and low water. But the highs are getting higher, and there's probably an explanation for it is probably because of rising temperature. There's more evaporation over the Great Plains. That saturated air is sweeping eastward on the prevailing winds. And when it crosses over Lake Michigan and Lake Superior, it condenses into rain in the summer and snow in the fall. And so our rain and snowfall amounts are on the increase. And so we can expect this high water to continue. So whenever there's a storm now, it washes out more and more of the shore. Where I live near Traverse City, just down the road from us, there's a long section of road that actually just washed away. It's down to one lane now. It's blocked off from automobile traffic. There's just one lane left, and then it's a sheer drop into Grand Traverse Bay. That's happening all over the Great Lakes.
We need to take a break. In a minute, disrupted winters, the slow roll of spring, and how places are a repository of memory. We'll be right back.
Support for the Stateside Podcast comes from the University of Michigan's Go Blue Guarantee, committed to keeping a U of M undergraduate education within reach of all Michigan residents, regardless of socioeconomic status. Programs are available for all three campuses. More at goblueguarantee.umich.edu.
Support for Michigan Public's Stateside Podcast comes from Lake Trust Credit Union, working to empower financial well-being for Michigan consumers, businesses, and communities. Committed to financial solutions and advice to support people and families. More information at laketrust.org.
Winters up north are pretty storied and much discussed, but what did you want the uninitiated to know about that season?
Well, it's unpredictable. We see just about everything in winter and always have. There are stretches. We had a stretch of 5 weekends in a row a few years ago where there was a blizzard starting Friday afternoon or Friday evening and extended through Sunday, where basically everything shut down, and our children and neighborhood children were pretty outraged because they didn't miss any school. Monday through Friday was fine, and the weekends it blizzard. Not just a little snow either, it was a lot of snow. Mm. That unpredictability. Then we're having, you know, it used to be the January thaw was semi-mythical. It often happened. There'd be a couple days in January when the temperature would get up to around 40 or into the low 40s, and you'd have some runoff, a little bit of dripping, and then it would get back to normal. Now our January thaw has extended some years into a couple weeks, and the temperature is, you know, alarmingly high, into the 50s, 60s, even 70. A few years ago, I was in Costa Rica on March 3rd, and where I was in Costa Rica, it was 80 degrees, and I went online and checked the weather back home where there had been a blizzard just before I left, and it was 82 degrees in Traverse City, so it was warmer there than it was near the equator. That kind of unpredictability has changed everything. The ski resorts are having a hard time. Cross-country skiing fans are finding it more and more difficult. Snowmobiling is real dicey some years. But there's still that beautiful factor. We still have what my friend Tom Carney calls lyrical snowfalls. We have these big flakes falling down with no wind. It creates a wonderful silence around us. And you can still get out and enjoy what feels like a classic northern winter.
I can't believe I'm saying this, Jerry, but you're actually making me feel like running towards January, and that does not happen. The portion of the book where you talk about spring really got my attention, too. And there's a passage early on in the book where you talk about spring being the most complicated season. It approaches incrementally, and I'm quoting here, pulling its clanging train of machinery. And a few weeks in, we realize that the name we've given it is wrong. It doesn't spring. It slides. It's 2 step forward, 1 step back, and then halts altogether like a child in a sulk. That's so identifiable to anybody who's trying to get through until the sun and the birdsong comes back again. I just love the way you talk about it in fits and starts.
Thank you. I think that's an observation that goes back to childhood, and I think many of us can relate to that, because by March, as a kid, you're ready for spring. You're excited about spring because It means not having to wear boots and hats and mittens. It means being able to stomp around in mud puddles instead of wading through snow. Especially, it's taking you towards summer vacation, of course, you know. And so every day is an adventure. You look for those changes. You look for the first buds to start swelling and any opportunity to get outside and be part of that. And yet, and to, you know, you want to fly your kite, but it's 34 degrees and the wind is at 30 miles an hour and it's tearing the kite out of your hand. You have to be patient. You have to watch and wait and wait and wait. And it seems to take forever.
I don't want to take away from the words in the book, but I did want to ask you about the illustrations for each chapter. They're really wonderful. Who did them?
Thank you. Well, that's my great friend, Glenn Wolf, one of the finest artists in northern Michigan. Glenn and I have collaborated on books since 1992, the book I mentioned earlier, It's Raining Frogs and Fishes. Glenn is best known for illustrating the outdoor page of the New York Times for many years, and is just wonderful. And he and I both grew up in Traverse City. We were a year apart in high school, and he just gets my work more than anybody does, and I get his, and we are always on the same page.
The illustrations are a series of black and white. I think they're woodcuts, yes?
They're linoleum cuts, so similar.
Linoleum cuts, okay, yeah. Each one has a scene of a landscape, but also focuses your attention on detailing little facets of what's going on in the scene. Did you two talk about the approach, or was that just his intuitive feel?
Yeah, it's always intuitive with Glenn, and we talk about it, but basically I send him in many cases, a very rough draft, just an outline of what I want to write about and a few details that I want to put in it. And when he sends back his sketch, it's almost always, 99% of the time, it's spot on with what I was visualizing as well. So we trust each other completely in that process.
Yeah. What he's done visually is kind of similar to the way you've put the book together. There are a lot of small chapters here dedicated to different facets of the land in each of the seasons that you talk about. Would you say that that's close to your experience of it, is sort of reveling in the details?
It is. That's what interests me. And that's probably the way I think, is I will focus on one small thing until I'm ready to move on. Until something else grabs my attention, then I'll move on. So I've always kind of wanted to do a book like this with quite short chapters. They're 500 to 1,000 words, many of them, 3-4 pages. And it seemed like a really accurate way to portray some of the subjects that I wanted to explore without, you know, padding or anything. You know, so many nonfiction books tend to, I feel like, go on a little too long about a subject.
Yeah. Jerry, one of the real pleasures of the book was visiting with you all the places that you talk about. And there are wonderful parts where you mention places that you found and then never found again when you were roaming around as a kid. And it just added to this feeling of how special our wild places are. But I wonder, are there any places that have become more important to you in recent years, maybe during the pandemic or just as you've approached this time of writing the book?
There are many. I'm really lucky to live where I do. We live on Old Mission Peninsula on what was once a cherry farm. It's a 150-year-old house sitting on an acre of land with two cherry trees left. But I can walk out my door and cross the field into woods or drive a few miles to public trails and a public park that is hundreds of acres, thousands of acres, and these trails just go for miles. And so those places have became very important in the pandemic because they were so easy to get to, and I could do that every day. But there's also the fact, the element of living in a place for virtually your whole life and the memories that start to build up. There are places all over the UP and in northern Michigan, northern lower Michigan, that are just packed with emotions and memories for me because of the times I've spent there with people I care about. And I don't know if I'm being too fanciful, but it's always seemed to me that I could go to one of those places blindfolded. Somebody could lead me there, spin me in circles, lead me there, open my eyes, and I would know exactly where I was because of that unique combination of aromas and color and light and plant varieties that, you know, just trigger these memories. I thought, oh yeah, this is the stretch of river that Craig Date and I canoed in 1985, you know, and I will remember it vividly. And I think that can only happen if you've spent, you know, many, many years in one place.
Jerry Dennis's latest book is called Up North in Michigan. He's doing a book signing at Horizon Books in Traverse City on Saturday, October 2nd. If you are not up north or you cannot get there, just look for it at your favorite local bookseller. And that's the Stateside Podcast for today. I'm April Baer. You can find full Stateside shows at michiganradio.org. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Today's episode was produced by Rachel Ishikawa and Mercedes Mejia with help from Mike Blank. Our theme music is by 14KT. Additional music from Blue Dot Sessions. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.